Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. How will TV expand and evolve next year? Get some perspective from Emerging Tech Exchange President and CEO Greg Kahn when he joins me next. Family Affair started a successful affair with viewers 55 years ago on CBS. That viewer connection continues through co-star Kathy Garber, who you'll be with next half hour. Our second hour kicks off with a preview of Joe Pickett, the latest Spectrum original series adapted from the best-selling novels. Executive producers John Eric Dowdle, Drew Dowdle, and Pickett authors DJ Box will be on hand. And Lost in Space third and final Netflix season takes off Wednesday. The captain of this adventure, adapter, executive producer, and showrunner Zach Estrin will highlight our closing 30 minutes. Also ahead, a Last Tango miniseries, a female Ellery Queen, a new classic trivia question, and someone TV let get away. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio. I present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network, Verbal, Reason, Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Music. This just in, it's Cyber Monday 2021, and tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book or two when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. Happy Cyber Monday 2021. Happy first day of Hanukkah, those of you celebrating that holiday. And we welcome you wherever you are to the program about TV's current and future. We have a big two-hour show for you today. Stay with us if you can. Bring your friends aboard. It's going to be amazing. And you can be involved with any or all of our guests. It's so simple. Pick up the phone and call in with this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway, or catch us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, TuneIn Radio. For some reason, the gremlins that paralyzed our chat room on our last episode, Wednesday, day before Thanksgiving, they're still out there. So we'll talk to Blog Talk Radio about that, and hopefully we'll get the chat room back up and running on our next show. Another big two-hour extravaganza coming your way this Wednesday to kick off December. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk speaker, tune in screen. Follow the instructions. Other people can be live with you. 42 degrees at the top of the hour, and Greg Kahn from the Emerging Tech Exchange joins me live from Montclair, New Jersey, after these news notes. Last Tango in Paris, one of the most controversial movies of the 1970s, may become the subject of a TV miniseries put into development earlier today. Tango, coming from CBS Studios, centers on production of the 1972 movie starring Marlon Brando and Maria Schneider, directed by Bernardo Bertolucci. The movie became notorious for its erotic scenes and post-premiere disclosures by Schneider over her treatment on and off camera. Stampede Ventures will co-develop Tango with CBS Studios, which is expected to start a worldwide distribution drive early next year. Another Ellery Queen television series, the first in a few decades, is in the works. Incendo and Black Box Multimedia are sending up their take on the popular crime-solving sleuth, which first landed on the tube in the early 1950s. This time, and for the first time, Ellery Queen will be female. No word yet on who will play this Ellery Queen. Now quickies, Judge Steve Harvey, the first non-Family Feud Harvey series on ABC since Thunderdome, will premiere January 4th. Some 957,000 viewers watched The Walton's Homecoming on the CW last night. It was the first made-for-TV movie in the channel's 15-year existence. More Thanksgiving weekend viewership results. NBC's Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade last Thursday morning had 21.2 million people watching. That's about 1 million from 2020. And Shareable, the independent TV and web series festival, will go to Los Angeles for the first time in person next April. And that is news notes for today. And now joining me from Montclair, Jersey, to kick off our two-hour extravaganza, the president and chief executive of was the Internet of Things Consortium, now the Emerging Tech Exchange. He's back with us for the second time, Greg Kahn. Greg, welcome back and happy after Thanksgiving.
Simon, terrific to be back. Happy end of Thanksgiving. Happy Hanukkah to you and your listeners, for everyone celebrating. Thrilled to be here.
Thank you. First of all, before we get into your thoughts about where TV stands for the next year and beyond, why was the name change from Internet of Things Consortium to Emerging Tech?
Great question, Simon. So as you know, we started the Internet of Things Consortium, or IOTC, 6 years ago, when connected devices really became an industry in and of itself. But the marketplace has moved beyond just connected devices, or IoT, to many other types of technologies, including metaverse, augmented reality.
Greg, go ahead.
Internet of Things Consortium. systems are in the process or have been transformed digitally. And they're looking for end-to-end solutions. They're looking for a platform to discuss all emerging technology. And so we take the heritage of IOTC into today's world, into end of 2021, and we're covering all of these types of emerging technologies, some mainstream pretty quickly. So it's an exciting time for us as an organization and for the industry at large.
Mm-hmm. We're getting near the end of 2021. Prediction or forecast did your new group make about television that has come to pass? And what also has been maybe the most revelatory, off-center, out-of-left-field moment that you think television happened or had happened to it as a medium this year?
Sure. Well, let's talk about just what has happened that we predicted years ago, which is that the television would become much more than just an entertainment device. It would be multidimensional, but it would be an interactive medium. Some call it a smart TV. I call it a digital TV or digital unit. But essentially, the platform is used from everything from education to commerce to medicine, to connectivity, broader connectivity within the home, to fitness, you name it. It's been used for way more than it had been years and years ago. So that's come to fruition. I think what sort of, out of left field is the pace of acceleration that took place during the global pandemic that we're still in, whether we call it a pandemic or an endemic. I would say that, I use the phrase, Simon, that gaming or gamification has come out of the basement and has really become core to the television platforms. And so, we're really just seeing an explosion of gamification in all types of content. And so that's something that I don't know, I would say is out of left field, but I would say it's certainly out of the basement and now into the main home.
Greg, how do you define gamification?
How do I define gamification? Essentially, it's bringing gaming principles into all types of platforms. So, essentially, it's a strategy for influencing and motivating the behavior of people, which are consumers, but also it could be employees, but using gaming principles. So that's sort of the notion of gamification. It's creating similar experiences to those which are experienced when people are playing games in order to motivate and engage users.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of gamification or staying with that subject, one thing that really became clear is that you have, as far as the TV set goes, you've got Roku now, we understand, is now running casual games on their devices, which was not the case a year ago. You have Google Stadia. You have Apple Arcade, which both can be played on smart TV sets and smart devices. There's talk still at Xbox from Microsoft may get into the action. And there has been some rumors here and there that some of the major game publishers may start to either A, put their games on the television set or adapt their games for live action or animated TV series. What's your sense of where this trend is going to go?
Look, I think you encapsulated it really well, Simon, which is that you're seeing coopetition happening in all different forms and directions. So, companies that are providing streaming services are directly getting into the gaming space. Publishers are looking to have more direct contact monetization with consumers themselves. And everybody is sort of in the camp of competing with one another. And that doesn't just relate to gaming. That also relates to the video content, that to music content, it relates to fitness content, educational content, that everybody is sort of playing in this world together. Where is it ultimately going is that you're just going to see gaming appear on more and more devices. And by the way, it's not just on the television or the mobile device. It'll also be on digital assistants and other platforms as well, Simon. So you're seeing it happen on car dashboards already, right, as another screen, if you will, that's adopted gamification or gaming itself. So lots of coopetition is where I see this going. And, in some ways, there'll be new revenue models that are created. There'll be some new services that are bundled together, gaming being one of them. And there'll probably also be a lot more confusion in the marketplace as to where do you go to get the content or the gaming that you that a consumer might want to get. Or in taking it even further, does a consumer even have more power than she or he might have today in terms of defining where he or she goes? So it's going to be an incredibly interesting, not just year ahead, but decade ahead to see this co-opetition, sort of how all these companies interplay, who forms partnerships with whom, and the role that the consumer plays in the interaction with these platforms.
One more gaming question before we move on. What do you think about Netflix's move into the gaming space, first with mobile games and maybe down the road with interactive TV games?
Well, Simon, I mean, that's an example where I said it's clear that gamification has come out of the basement. I think it was a real, 2 days ago, I know Netflix surprised subscribers with two free games. You know, I think the reality is that Netflix realizes that it needs new revenue streams to continue to show Wall Street that it's a growth story. It hasn't moved into advertising yet. There's been a lot of speculation about whether it will or not. But gaming is clearly, an area that they see growing and that they can have a meaningful share in. And so I think it's a direction for the marketplace. They're essentially talking to their subscribers, not just about more movies or TV shows, but games and also mobile games. And so it also speaks to the fact that Netflix sees its subscriber moving beyond just the TV and even perhaps, to the mobile phone, but even past the mobile phone. As I mentioned, sort of the car being, a platform where we talk about mobile devices. We often talk about the smartphone, but the ultimate mobile device is an automobile. And Netflix is already on car platforms. So perhaps it wants to tap into that slice of the marketplace as well. But it's definitely a strong signal to the marketplace that gaming perhaps has been under-leveraged by a lot of these companies and tends to be a major player in it.
You're hearing Greg Kahn. He is the president and chief executive of what was the Internet of Things Consortium and is now, as of a few weeks ago, the Emerging Tech Exchange. He joins us live from Montclair, New Jersey this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. And we're just kicking off a big two-hour edition of the program about TV's current and future. And we're glad you're along for the ride. Simon, I'm with you live from New York. 42 degrees at the top of the hour. You have a question or comment for our guests. Ring that phone, 646-652-2906, 652-2906. We have another big two-hour edition of our show that comes your way less than 48 hours from now. That's on Wednesday, first day of December 2021. And boy, we have another great lineup for you. We kick it off with an hour devoted to two programming services, one that just started a few weeks ago and another that is trying to make a big leap up and become the Netflix of environmental programming. I'm speaking about Swerve TV and its service, Swerve Sports. And we'll have Steve Shan, the former Roku executive, who's the chief executive officer of Swerve TV. He'll be our lead guest. And in the second half hour, we'll have the former head of Ride TV, who just went aboard EarthX Television as its head. And he has brought in a new executive team to take that service to a bigger, greater level, not just nationwide, but worldwide. And that's just the first hour. On our second hour, Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist does its holiday finale on Wednesday, and we'll have a live streaming interview with the creator executive producer of that award-winning NBC, now Roku program, Austin Weinberg. And finally, from the first ever Real Housewives of the North Pole made-for-TV movie, that's right, the first Real Housewives made-for-TV scripted movie coming to Peacock next week, we've got the co-stars, Betsy Brandt and Real Housewives of L.A. star Kyle Richards. They'll be with us live on a special big two-hour edition. Don't you dare miss it. That's Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here exclusively on Tomorrow Be Televised. Greg, a couple of weeks ago, Magid, the media research firm, and Vizio, the smart TV set maker, came out with a very illuminating study about smart TV uses. They surveyed about 600 people, and one of the things they wanted to know was what interactive applications they would like to see delivered on their television sets. And it was anywhere, depending on the application, from 40% to 52% of those surveyed. For example, 52% said, I want my live weather and traffic reports. I want to interact with them on the TV set. 47% said, I want my home security system on TV. 47% said, I want to order food and put the menus on the TV set. 45% purchase products and merchandise. 40% the webcam. and less than 40 and near 40% sports betting. What's your sense about the consumer toward interactive television, and how do you think that's going to manifest itself on smart TV sets and devices next year?
Yeah, so first, great question. And, you know, Simon, we've seen a lot of not only growth of consumption, purchase first and usage of smart TV sets, but just the wide range of tools or the wide range of ways that people are using these sets. And you mentioned a couple of interesting ones. First, you mentioned security, and I'll take that even a step further, is that we've covered the digital home for years in the IoT consortium, now the Emerging Tech Exchange, and smart doorbells and security cameras have really taken off during this COVID period. And so essentially, what are they providing? They're providing live video streams into the home, right? And so where do people want to see those live video streams? They want to see it on their television. They want to see not only from a security standpoint, but when their mail is being delivered, or maybe their kids are coming home from school, or someone's coming shoveling their snow, et cetera, et cetera. So that's definitely an area that folks are looking for their television going forward. Another one, you know, you mentioned e-commerce. We are just scratching the surface of e-commerce. I think this is the first year in mass where we're seeing live shopping take place on many, many platforms, you know, platforms like NBCU, but then also all of the social platforms are introducing new live shopping occasions. I think there's a huge opportunity within the smart TV for that type of application. Third, I would say fitness. You're seeing Peloton and new LG TVs. They just announced a partnership, but you'll start to be able to get Peloton content on the smart TVs. I think you're really going to see a further explosion of that going forward. We talked a little bit about gamification before. I think there's a lot more happening on the music side of things. And you brought up, you know, esports as an area of growth. You know, one other area that I think that there could be a lot more of is the automation within the home, and that still remains to be seen as to whether the television will be the hub that connects all of these devices or whether there'll be a different type of digital assistant that does that. But as you know, there are just many, many, many use cases of what a television can be deployed for. And as we know, many households have up to 10, you know, 10 plus TVs. And so it's a big, big opportunity to think about, you know, for if you are a service provider, number one, how do you make your subscription stickier? And if you're a consumer, you know, ultimately, how can you get more value out of the TV? Two areas that I mentioned at the top of this conversation, Simon, is telemedicine, which is an area that is just starting to really take off. It did during COVID, but as an industry, it's really just starting to take off. And then the second is education. Is that we all saw this year that so many kids were home in the pandemic and were required to use their computers for the first time ever to learn. But that's not stopping. Even if people are back in the classroom, it's now opened the door to say, can the TV be an educational tool, maybe as a supplement to school or for certain individuals that don't want to go to a physical school? So lots of opportunities and, again, exciting time to be in the space.
How much does both the medical and the educational community know about the TV opportunities? We've been following them on our show, Gray. We had MedSign on last year. We had them on a few weeks ago. That's one of the telehealth on the television set ventures where you can talk to your doctor. The doctor can show you medical information, maybe even order products and services for the TV set. We had Books on recently, which is a storybook animation service that's available now on most smart TV sets and devices. You still get a sense, though, that that both these communities don't know or are not being given the opportunity to see the opportunities, the interactive TV opportunities in these marketplaces.
I completely agree. And, Simon, I would say, to answer your question, that there's still much more of a connection point that needs to be made, no pun intended. The market is incredibly fragmented. And so, you know, one of the things we're getting ready for the upcoming CES show in Las Vegas in January, and CES always brings together individuals from many different sectors. And that's really an opportunity, not just at the particular show in Las Vegas. There is a bigger opportunity to bring the TV manufacturers with the content providers, with these sort of vertical experts, if you will, medical, education, and others, to really figure out new models. And I mentioned you know, the health and wellness space, which includes the medical space. But I mentioned Peloton, you know, starting to think about TV partnerships for the first time. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. But you have to bring these individuals together. They operate in very, very different ecosystems. First of all, the medical industry in and of itself is very fragmented, as is the education industry. And then you have the whole TV industry. So you need platforms to be able to bring these folks together. And that's by nature what we do at Emerging Tech Exchange. But there's a lot more work to be done. I think, if anything, this year showed that there is more work to be done. And here's the other thing, Simon, is that the infrastructure bill just got passed in Washington, D.C. The monies haven't been deployed yet. And part of that a big chunk of it is going to go to broadband access around the country. And so, you know, you have to make sure that everybody has the right connectivity to use all of these potential applications as well. And the government is, you know, on both sides of the aisle are clearly understand that. So now that it has been passed and will be deployed, there will be much more opportunity and probably more of a spotlight on other use cases for the television manufacturers and the service providers to open up and to enter into. So I would say we're still in the first inning, but big potential.
In a moment, we're going to ask Ray what he thinks about the metaverse and what role TV can play in that, a big role, a minor role, et cetera. He is, of course, the head of the Emerging Tech Exchange, formerly Internet Things Consortium, joins us live from Montclair, New Jersey, this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. And if you have a question in our remaining minutes with Greg, make that call, 646-652-2906. Coming up toward the top of the hour, classic trivia question segment. We'll give you the answer to our question we've been running the last 2 weeks, and then we'll bring you a new question. Stand by, because you could win 4 prizes. Great post-Thanksgiving stuff for you if you got the correct answer. So stay tuned for that. Greg, a lot of talk about the metaverse, and it was interesting when I saw the presentation Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook, now Meta, did. He had nothing to say about TV, despite the fact that he has a smart TV product called Portal TV, which has now been around for just started its third year, which allows you to video chat on the TV set and do augmented reality to create characters in storytelling situations. What's your sense about the metaverse, and how do you define it, and what role can TV play in it?
All right, so let's start with the definition of metaverse, and it's sort of a very meta conversation. Is that I was on a larger session with about 50 executives when Mark announced about the metaverse, when Mark announced that he was changing the name to Meta. So it was very meta. Here's how I define the metaverse, Simon. It's a digital reality that combines aspects of virtual reality, augmented reality, gaming, social media, cryptocurrencies that allow users to interact virtually. Okay, so, you know, augmented reality we know overlays visual elements as well as sound, other sensory input into real-world settings to enhance user experiences. As the metaverse grows, it's going to create spaces where user interactions are more multidimensional than current technology supports. So instead of just viewing content, if you're in the metaverse, you'll be able to immerse yourself in a space where the digital and physical worlds converge. Okay, so some folks are calling that digital as a hybrid of digital and physical. How does that play into the TV space? In a number of different ways. You mentioned that Facebook/Meta, you know, has a product that is applicable to the TV that essentially helps to broadcast Instagram filters, et cetera, to the television. And others are starting to play around as well. Peloton, as an example, is also launching cameras so that their content could be directly broadcast to the television if you don't have a smart TV like the LG one that they're partnering with. But essentially, the metaverse goes beyond the TV and goes to all of the different form factors that include goggles, include, you know, any kind of headgear, include your watch, include your digital assistants, include your Nest devices, include certainly your mobile phones, your laptops, your tablets. So it really touches every single screen that is around a consumer today. And the question for you know, the television industry as a whole is that as we think about content moving to all of these different channels, and as we think about content becoming more interactive, and as we see these different technologies coming together, what are the business models that have to be created that make it viable? But we know that you know, Mark mentioned that the company is putting $10 billion into this space. Microsoft has also very publicly branded themselves or positioned themselves as taking advantage of the metaverse. And so, Simon, this is not just a shiny toy. This is where the industry is going, and we all have to figure it out. Now, some applications of this, and these are pieces of the metaverse I mentioned, you know, there could be individuals that are using a VR device and other people are watching it on the television. There are companies that are already developing platforms for NFTs on the television themselves. So that is a piece of the metaverse. I mentioned the cryptocurrency is also a piece of the metaverse. So, you know, lots more to come, and it's still very new. I'm actually headed down to Miami this week to Art Basel, where there's a lot of conversation about the integration of art and crypto and NFT and how that all comes together. But television and the television ecosystem will definitely have a play. The question is, though, is how does it manifest within the current service providers that are out there today? Which new ones will be popping up? And what are the business models that we should be looking forward to going forward?
Yeah. And incidentally, Bob Chapek, head of Disney, in an interview with CNBC a few weeks ago, told Judy Boston, a media correspondent, that Disney Plus is going to be a metaverse play, although he did not elaborate on how and so on and so forth. And by the way, if you talk to those NFT on TV companies, please tell them to come on our show. We'd love to showcase them. And that's another thing, of course, to watch is the fact that cryptocurrency and blockchain are now trying to get new plumbing services and new plumbing series off the ground. With the new format for the Emerging Tech Exchange, before the pandemic, you had done a conference here in New York. You had special things virtually. What is the game plan for 2022 in terms of trying to bring the various parties together in public for discussion about where we're going?
Yeah, Simon, so we are getting back to in person. We actually have an event tomorrow night in New York City. We are hosting a new digital series called Emerging Tech Bites. That is taking place every Wednesday. So this Wednesday's is on electric and connected vehicles, and we'll have Ford and Honda and Intel as part of that discussion. So we're doing that every Wednesday. Next week's actually will be on the metaverse. So if anyone wants to join that discussion, you can reach out to me through Simon and get more information on that. And at CES, as I mentioned, we're hosting about 8 different events on all these different things, including the metaverse. Including connected TV. So lots of opportunity. You mentioned the in-person summit that we have. We are planning to have an in-person summit back in 2022. As soon as we wade ourselves through the latest COVID variant, but we are planning on moving forward, and we're optimistic that we will be able to move forward. So keep an eye out for more information on that. It will likely be in early fall 2022. And I think we're all reaching a point where people want to get together in person to exchange information. It's great to talk about things virtually, digitally, but there's a key piece that has been missing over the past 2 years, which is that relationship building and that networking and that partnership development. And we're going to be organizing a lot of different types of platforms over the next couple of quarters to make sure that, as you mentioned, the folks that need to interact with the connected TV ecosystem have that opportunity to do so. So really appreciate you inviting me on today to share some of my points of view on where the industry is heading.
And it's heading in a lot of different directions at the same time. I'm really thrilled that that conference is going to be back. Hopefully it will be in New York or somewhere place close. And we can have more conversation because what was really important, you said, is the industries must have a dialogue. And that includes the retail industry, the advertising people, the various websites, and so on and so forth to really see where TV can play a role. So a lot of industries can come together, and your organization is definitely a way to go. And if you want more details about Greg's organization, here's where you go online, www.emerging.com. It's www.emergingtechexchange.com. Greg, thank you so much for coming back. Keep us posted. I definitely want to check out the digital bites coming up. We've got that metaverse one. I know you got a smart TV one coming up too. And we'd love to have you back as soon as possible in 2022 to keep the conversation going.
Happy holidays, Simon, and to your audience as well. Look forward to seeing you in person very soon.
For sure. All the greatest, Greg. Take care. Happy holiday season to you and your gang. Greg Kahn, the President and Chief Executive of the Emergent Tech Exchange, joining us from Montclair, New Jersey. When we come back, Family Affair co-star Kathy Garver, she will join us live from Bel Canty, California. She's coming your way after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, tunein.com, together reaching over 65 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Don't forget, tonight, one of Blog Talk Radio's most popular shows comes your way, the Kia D Unplugged Show, first post-Thanksgiving edition, and it comes your way tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. That's 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, the Kia D Unplugged Show, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best speech chart 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to our second half hour of this two-hour extravaganza, wrapping up November 2021 here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Time to run with you live from New York. If you have a question or comment for our guests ahead, give us a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. A half century and 5 years ago, CBS premiered a comedy that turned out to be a winner called Family Affair. It ran five seasons, and its presence is still being felt, I'm sure, somewhere in the nation or somewhere in the world through reruns. My next guest was one of the people who made Family Affair happen for so many people. She played Sissy, the oldest child on that series that starred Brian Keith and Sebastian Cabot. Joining us live in an internet radio exclusive from Bel Canty, California, Kathy Garver. Kathy, happy post-Thanksgiving and welcome to our program.
Thank you so much, Simon. I'm very happy to be here.
And it's a pleasure to have you here, Kathy. You have done a number of books about Family Affair and your roles since. And now here we are, year 55. Why do you, and you have a scrapbook that just came out a few months ago. Why do you keep authoring about your biggest role?
Because I really think that it has a presence today. Your first guest was so interesting with all the tech and everything that's going on. But there is such a need, I think, for the understanding of what built television, what's the history of television, why some shows were so popular, and why you can have some shows on today that fail, you know, after maybe three showings, even though they're super high tech and they're interactive and it's the next greatest thing. So I think it's important to look at the core of what made a classic show classic. And particularly for Family Affair, what I think makes it so classic, and as you say, it is still on. It's on Decades. It's on Roku. It's a DVD. It's playing all over the world. And it is the basic concept of story. What a concept. What an idea to have a problem and how you're going to solve that problem, solving that problem, the denouement, or what happens afterwards. And, you know, we can't certainly wrap up everything as we did back in the 60s and 70s with 22 minutes of the sitcom. But it gives a basis for something that can be accomplished through care, through understanding of other people, for not yelling at them, for not, slapping them, hitting them, having the violence, putting them down. Is that the kind of problem that this particular show was solving? No. Should that be the kinds of problems that people are trying to solve today? There, I don't think, is as much violence as is depicted on television. And once it's depicted, it seems to make an easy way for other people to model it. So, anyway, that is kind of a long-winded answer to why I'm still being a standard bearer for Family Affair after 55 years when I'm only 39. I don't know how this happened, but because I believe in the show.
When the cameras wrapped on that last episode in 1971 on CBS, did you and your fellow castmates, Brian Keith, Sebastian Cabot, Johnny Whitaker, Anissa Jones, everyone involved, Don Fedderson, the producer, I want to talk more about him, by the way, in a little bit. Did anybody think that this series was going to have this kind of afterlife?
Well, I think they did, as a matter of fact. In my newest book that just came out 2 weeks ago, the Family Affair scrapbook, and like the first chapter of it, besides having all the pictures, was how the show got started. And it was created by Don Fedderson and Ed Hartman. Now, Don Fedderson had a sterling career, not only in television, but in radio, and he had on My Three Sons. He created My Three Sons, which when Family Affair debuted, had already been running for about 7 years. So he kind of had a formula about what made a show popular. And Ed Hartman, who came from, also was with Don for My Three Sons, but also came from film with Abbott and Costello and Bob Hope with A Lemon Drop Kid and wonderful movies. So they were very confident, and CBS bought the show without even a pilot. They bought it on the premise. And they already guaranteed 32 episodes without even a pilot. Now that's, you know, very hard to see these days, which when everything is cut down to 8 episodes, and gee, I hope that we can stay on for 8 episodes, just because there are so many different platforms. And as your first guest says, well, there's even going to be more platforms. It was enough that we had 3 networks, and everybody watched those particular networks. Now we have 902, and who can watch anything? But they were so confident that when they designed the set, and you go look at the Family Affair set today, and it can be walking into like a modern place that hasn't really happened. This was in the height of the 60s. I was a teenager. I wanted to wear short little mini skirts, you know, and bugaboo. And the producer said, no, no, no. And, they kept it very classic in style. So even the costumes you will see were not so progressive for the times. My dresses were at knee level, and the shoes were all classic styles. So they were, even though they hadn't any idea about the total platforms that it would eventually land on, they knew that it was going to be around for a while. They wanted it to be around for a while. At that time, syndication was in. So they, after 3 years, they already started syndicating it. So it was showing not only at its regular time on Mondays on CBS at 9:30, but also it was being syndicated during the day. Again, my long answer, yes, they did have an idea, and they geared it towards longevity.
Kathy, how'd you get the role of Sissy?
Well, I had been working ever since I was a child, a little girl. My first role was in the Ten Commandments, not the silent version. For this particular role, I was going to school at UCLA, and my agent called, and they said, oh, you have to go see the producer of this new series. It's already been sold, and you have to be there this afternoon. I said, oh, okay. I was in a sorority house at Pi Phi at UCLA, and I didn't have a car. I'm calling my dear mother. I said, Mom. And so my agent said, everything is fine, except you have dark hair and dark eyes. I said, yes, I do. They said, they want a blonde, blue-eyed. I said, oh, okay. However, the casting director knew me, and so I was going straight to the producer. My mom says to me, don't worry, I've got this handled. I said, okay, Mom. So she comes over to the sorority house with this can of something in her hand, and it was called Streaks and Tips. So this, in the 60s, was this kind of sticky substance you put in your chair. You wouldn't know about this, Simon, but you spray your hair with this stuff, and it instantly makes it lighter, different color. Mom proudly holds up this spray can, says, here. So she sprays my hair. I look like something out of Goldfinger. If you touch my hair, it was like a helmet. But go in, and I meet with Ed Hartman, the creator producer, and we're having a nice little chat. And he said, what's the matter with your hair? And I said, my hair? And he said, yes, it's turning green. And I said, oh, this is wonderful. I certainly got this part. Well, it opened it up to conversation even more, and we laughed. And then I did a screen test with this long blonde, like Alice in Wonderland wig. I said, boy, is this going to be a whole thing about hair? And it happened very quickly because they were already shooting the pilot and they needed the teenage sister. Mm-hmm. So they called me 3 days later, and my agent says, well, you got the part. I said, I did? And they said, yes, with one caveat. And I said, what? They said, never wear that dress again and never wear that wig again. I said, you got it. So that is how I got that part.
You're hearing Kathy Garver, the co-star of Family Affair, which started on CBS 65 years ago and is the subject of her latest book, The Family Affair Scrapbook, that came out a few weeks ago. And she joins us live from Belcandy, California, this half hour on Tamarvi Televised and an internet radio exclusive. Simon, I'm with you from the other side of the nation in New York, where it's 42 degrees at the top of the hour. If you have a question or comment for Kathy, make that call and join in the interactive fun here on Tamarvi Televised. 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Numbers good anyway, or catch us with the country around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio Speaker or Tune In Radio. And coming up near the top of the hour, classic trivia question of the week. We have a brand new question for you. It will premiere before the bottom at the top of the hour, and you'll win four prizes in play, including Loud House crayons from Nickelodeon and two very interesting books, including a Betty White retrospective by Ray Richmond, who we had on the show earlier this month. Kathy, John Federson is someone that many people ought to know because in addition to producing and co-creating Family Affair, he also was the person that brought Betty White to national prominence on television in the 1950s, created one of the great anthology series of that era, The Millionaire. You mentioned My Three Sons. He also was involved with Lawrence Welk when ABC canceled his show, his Saturday Night Variety show. He took it to syndication and ran for another 10, 15 years. What was Don Federson like? Was he a hands-on person on the set? Did you see him regularly? Or did he leave it to his associate Fred Henry and Edmund Hartman to put you all through your paces?
He was pretty much the business person who put together the deals. And he was not such a creative force as was Ed Hartman, who wrote many of the scripts and was heralded and was the head of the Writers Guild for a while. So he was the creative person that was putting those things together. Don sat back and, as I said, made the deals, and he would look, though, at the dailies every day, see how things were going. And back then, well, we didn't have computers, but we had colored pages. So the script would start out white, then you would get the changes on a blue, and then you get the changes on a pink, and then you would get changes on yellow pages. So one might get those at the very beginning of the day, and that was after Don had seen the dailies and would change up and say, well, we need to do this and we need to do that.
Mm-hmm. What was it like working with Brian Keith and Sebastian Cabot, who, because of this series, they became comedy stars? If you know their careers, Brian Keith was involved with two television series in the 50s, Crusader, and then an excellent show that Sam Peckinpah created for Four Star called The Westerner, that only ran 13 episodes. It's one of the best westerns, by the way, ever made for television. And Sebastian Cabot was involved with another popular CBS show for two seasons called Checkmate. But they were known more as dramatic actors, both in film and TV. And then Family Affair, just in respects, brought a whole new dimension to them as comedy actors.
Well, yes, and Brian, interestingly enough, I appeared in The Crusader with him. I played a waif in that. And then when you mentioned The Millionaire that Don Federson did, I was also, as a child actor, in The Millionaire. And from my other book, my Surviving Sissy memoir, it was interesting to me how close in many ways, and maybe there just weren't so many people that child actors were involved in all of these things. Brian Keith, who was such a wonderful, dramatic actor and a real macho kind of guy, I think what really changed his career was The Parent Trap. And he did The Parent Trap right before Family Affair, and that really kind of broke his egg of drama and allowed him to be this cute little chick on comedy. And he really did have a comedy flair for the family. He loved children, just loved kids. He had this natural propinquity towards little ones, and he adopted three and had three of his own. He was very much a family man, and Sebastian as well, even though that he was trained, he left formal education when he was maybe 14, but his his theatrical education continued, and he was a very good dramatic actor. And as you say, Checkmate, I love Checkmate. Sometimes some of the best comedy, I think, comes from the reality of the humor. Like, it's not funny to a person who slips on the banana peel, but people watching it think that's pretty funny. So if the person who is doing the comedy, like Sebastian or Brian, has this reality about it, it's very humorous. And I think, in my estimation, that's some of the best kinds of humor. Like today, they're just the one-line jokes and the one-line jokes. They don't develop the story and all of that. And you don't have the same kind of feeling, I don't think, that you do from the situational comedy characters that are really feeling the what's going on and how they are going to solve it. And Brian and Sebastian were quite different in their approach to acting, whereas Sebastian, it was difficult for him to learn lines in the first place, but he would spend hours and weekends learning every single word exactly as it was put down by the writer. And Brian would come in the day of shooting and say, oh, okay, well, what do we have today? Oh, is that it? Uh-huh, all right, okay, I got it. So he got primarily the gist of it and would interpret it in his own inimical manner. So I think it became a wonderful kind of dynamic between the two, and that also served our show well.
A couple of other dynamics that I'd like to get your thoughts on, Kathy. One is the dynamic you with Johnny and Anissa, as all three as the kids that Brian and Sebastian get to adopt. And the second is the sense that the show had an elegance to it. You could hear it in Frank Duvall's theme music. You could hear that. You could see in that kaleidoscope, you know, with the open family affair and so forth. There seemed to be this sort of sense of both elegance and sophistication to the show, but also there was it was like on the other flip of the coin, it was the byplay that you and Johnny and Anissa had.
Well, now that's an interesting concept. Not a lot of people have ever brought up the elegance of the show, but I think you are absolutely correct. And here we are in a posh New York penthouse apartment taking up primarily the whole floor. So the set design had a certain grace about it. Brian, in his low-keyed manner, that was something that, I mean, there was no yelling and screaming at each other that you might hear so much today. So that, I think, all folded into the grace of it. There was joy in it. There was genuine love. And all those things are, I think, traits of grace and of elegance. And the very well-dressed are, well, we would call him a Manny today, I guess, our gentleman's gentleman, who gave that touch of class. And when he was out of the picture in the first episode, because he had hurt his arm, and John Williams, who is just the height of elegance, who was played Sabrina's father, fabulous movie Sabrina, and played a butler, but. So you have the elegance and the upper classness, might I say, of this very sophisticated New York apartment, and Brian, who was an intelligent engineer. I, as a teenager growing up, and as I said, I was already in college when I was playing this 15-year-old, but it's a good thing that I'm like 5'1" and have this little baby face and I'm and a certain amount of energy. So I could always have played younger than I am. I'm really 104. So this 55th anniversary of Family Affair really, yeah, I could say a drop in the age pile. But I digress. Anissa and Johnny were innocent. And I was, you know, hopefully a picture of responsibility. But in many ways, it reminds me of like when Shirley Temple emerged in out of World War II. And that just sweet, innocent, adorable, curly-haired, talented child. And so Anissa became very well-known. Again, to me, here we are in the Vietnamese War, and there's protesters, and there's chaos, and on television you can actually see people getting really shot, which had never taken place before, and in color, which was one of the first shows in color. So here you have the innocence. And so I think that whole bundle came to be, and perhaps it emerged as elegance with some light laughter, but it was a dramedy more than a comedy. There was the drama with the comedy. So thank you for saying it was elegant. I'm going to remember that. I'll remember you for that, Simon. I think that's quite nice.
All right, I got that, Kathy. Kathy Garver from Family Affairs. She's our guest this half hour on Smart Beach Televised live from Del Carrey, California. If you have a question or comment meeting this with her, make that call, 646-652-2906. And as I said, we're just getting started. We're getting ready to wrap up our first hour of this two-hour edition of Smart Beach Televised. And coming up in our second hour, we've got the gang from Joe Pickett. That's the brand-new series on Spectrum Originals that begins next Monday. We have executive producers John Eric Dowdle, Drew Dowdle, and the author of the Joe Pickett books the series is based on, and that's CJ Box. And then our final half hour, we got another big internet radio exclusive for you, the adapter, executive producer and showrunner of Netflix's version of Lost in Space, which on Wednesday begins its third and final season, Zach Estrin. So stay tuned for all of that in our next hour. Kathy, when Family Affair was canceled, was there a sense of we did all we could do with the series, or was there a sense of we could go more, I wish we could go more? And in that light, what do you think about the possibility of, has there been any talk about, in this era of rebooting television series, rebooting Family Affair?
Well, when it was canceled, Don Federson did go to ABC because he did think it still had legs, but they had just signed the Brady Bunch and they thought it was too similar. CBS was changing over to more reality. The show was rebooted once, about 10 years ago. It lasted 9 episodes. I personally think a show has a much better chance of success if it's rebooted with the original cast. And as it turns out, the only ones left in our particular show is myself and Johnny Whitaker. We have a fabulous pitch that, and we've already done the pilot for Aunt Sissy, and And this is something I was thinking about in your first segment with Greg, that there is technology, yes, and then but don't forget that wonderful history and that comfort of nostalgia. And so it's our show would be in 8 episodes arcs of going into that new kind of format where we would have the Aunt Sissy first and then. Well, I'm not going to expose the whole wonderful, fabulous pitch, but it would fit right in, and it wouldn't be so far afield that we're just giving in to wokeism or we have to have this and we have to have that and we have to have that. No, we're going to base it on the story of how it evolved realistically, and if it comes in and different characters then come right in, then that's fine. And then they will be woven into the story as it evolves and it emerges. And it does. There will be prequel, sequel. So it will be an understanding of how the characters first got into being and then how what happened to them. And I think it'll be a great...
Never say never, because you got a lot of reboots now. We just had The Waltons' Homecoming, which I thought was a terrific movie on CW. And we've had some of the co-stars on our show last week. You have The Wonder Years on ABC, which we have the creator of that show, that series, doing great. And, of course, Norman Lear has been doing the live in front of the studio audience with Jimmy Kimmel, and they've got another segment coming up next month.
Yes, and, you know, as I say, I think that you can blend the new high-tech and you can put them on different platforms, Netflix. I hope you're listening to this now, Zach. Because if he can bring Lost in Space back to Netflix, I think he can bring Aunt Sissy, Family Affair back to Netflix.
I will ask him about that. And by the way, you know, Lost in Space was on at the same time that, for the most part, that your show was on, because Lost in Space ran 3 seasons, and I think it overlapped your show at least for 2 of those 3.
Right, so I didn't get to see them. In 1966, when we debuted, the Monkees debuted, Batman debuted. Now, Mickey Dolenz lives in Del Canyon, where I live. It's kind of a gated community near Calabasas. But we never saw each other's shows because we were working. And same with my 3 sons. They were shooting right next door to us at CBS Studio Center. But I never even met Stan and Barry until much later, after, you know, 20 years later. So it's nice to see the people you work with but don't.
Before you go, Kathy, anything you're working on, voiceover or any acting, besides what you're doing with the scrapbook?
Yes, so I'm just finishing up a movie called Old Man Jackson, and by Johnny Ray Gibbs, and I play Mrs. Jackson. I will be starting a new movie called The Broken Road in 2 months, and that concerns PTSD, but two people, it's a romance, two people on a broken road who really come together through a therapy equestrian center. And with all kinds of things. It's a fabulous script, and written by Tom Anderson, who is a retired colonel and has gotten great accolades. I'm the executive producer of a new show called Idle Chat, which is on Retro TV, and we have reunion of classic stars. Besides the At Sissy Pitch, I have the pilot for TV Dinners, and I just got an email from a wonderful network that wants to see the pitch again. And so lots of stuff going on, and I'm writing a new book called TV Dinners TV that will go along with our new show, TV Dinners. So I'm a busy person, and I have a 30-year-old son and his 30-year-old girlfriend who live in the house with my husband and me. So and I'm making an enchanted garden at the side of my house, so there's lots of things that are going on.
That's what you call a very full, wonderful life. And by the way, we had Idle Chat on our show about a month or two ago. So if you want to hear that episode with one of your fellow producers, or actually from Retro TV, the network is showing it, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. If you want to know more about what Kathy Garver is up to, there is a website you can check out. In addition to checking out her new book, Family Affairs Scrapbook, which I'm sure is available on Amazon.com, other places too, it's www.kathygarver.com. That's www.kathygarver, her name, all one, .com. The book is Family Affairs Scrapbook. We hope to offer it as an upcoming classic trivia prize. And, Kathy, when TV Dinners comes out, we would love to have you back on the show. It's been a fantastic half hour being with you.
Thank you, Simon. I've really enjoyed it. You're the tops.
Thank you. You too, Kathy. All the greatest. Take care.
Happy holidays.
You too. Kathy Garver from Family Affair joining us live from California. And again, the book is Family Affair Scrapbook. We hope to offer it very soon as a classic trivia segment prize. And speaking of the classic trivia segment, that's coming up in a moment. First, some words to find folks at audible.com. If you're a Nora Roberts fan, you know she writes very interesting dramatic books. She's got a new one out, and it's in audio form called The Becoming. And you can get it right now if you become a trial run member of audible.com. In case you don't know, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital entertainment, information, and inspiration. Over 250,000 titles to choose from, and you listen on any device, whatever you're hearing us on right now is Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio, and our various podcast sites. Remember, if you sign up at audibletrial.com/televised, you get one free audiobook, 1 month trial of this service, great customer service from Audible's parent, Amazon.com, and while the supply lasts, important health and wellness information. And get this. You're an Amazon Prime member already, 2 audiobooks for the trial of one, and as long as this lasts, if you become a member without the trial, you can get your first 3 months for $5.95 per month. That's the first 3 months of your subscription for $5.95 per month. This lasts only temporarily. So for all details, go to audibletrial.com/televised. Now it's time for our classic trivia question of the week. First of all, let's give you the answer to our question we've offered the last 2 weeks. Nobody got it, but here's the answer. Gil Faber was the lead character in what iconic TV series? The answer, Rawhide on CBS, which ran from 1959 till the mid-60s. And by the way, Gil Faber is played by Eric Fleming. He was a trail boss on that very popular show with the great theme music and all that. And, of course, it was a show that Clint Eastwood claimed to fame as his sidekick, Rowdy Yates. Well, here's another classic trivia question for you. The 4 prizes we offered last week, they're all still in play. We're talking about the books, The Unofficial Hocus Pocus Cookbook, The Betty White Retrospective, 100 Remarkable Moments in Extraordinary Life, Freak Brothers T-shirt based on the 2B series, and the Loud House crayon set from the folks at Nickelodeon. Here's the question. Raymond Burr was the first person to play Perry Mason, the famed defense attorney, on CBS. Who was the second? Raymond Burr was the first actor to play Perry Mason on CBS. Who was the second? Yes, on CBS. If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Please enclose your name and where you're emailing from. First correct answer, you win. If we don't get a winner by the end of today, we post a question tomorrow morning on Facebook and on Twitter. Facebook at Simon Applebaum and Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. So in order to win, get in there. And if we have time, we'll repeat the question before we wrap up an hour from now. And when we come back, we got another big hour still in store for you. We have coming up at the bottom of this hour, Zach Estrin, the adapter, executive producer, and showrunner of Netflix's Lost in Space, wraps up its final season, season three, this Wednesday. But first, Joe Pickett is a new series coming on Spectrum Originals a week from today. We've got the three key executive producers behind it. We'll have John Eric Dowdle, Drew Dowdle, and the author of the Joe Pickett books, DJ Box. They're all coming your way after we pause at the top of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, tune.com. Together we reach over 65 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Check out the January Jones Show, one of the most popular on BTR every week. It happens tomorrow, 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best we charge 24/7 at youtube.com. Welcome back to our second hour of Tomorrow Be Televised on this Cyber Monday 2021. Welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. It's time I'm with you along for the ride, and a great ride we've got going. 42 degrees at the top of the hour, and if you've got a question or comment for upcoming guests, make the phone go, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number is good anywhere you're catching us across the country, around the world, here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio. And, of course, you can also get involved with others through Facebook Timeline. Check on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk Speaker, TuneIn screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. Over the last few years, we have been covering the number of Spectrum Originals. That's original television series that are shown video on demand first on Spectrum's cable system that's owned by Charter Communications, one of the top cable operators in the country. We've brought you L.A.'s Finest, which also had a run on Fox in its two-season run. We've brought you Curfew out of England. We brought you Paradise Lost that also ran, I believe, on Paramount Network. And starting on Monday, the latest Spectrum Original series will debut. It's called Joe Pickett. It's about a game warden in a small rural town and what he has to deal with. The show will be on, again, Spectrum Originals, and then next year will run on Paramount Plus. We are delighted to have the three executive producers of the series joining us live from Los Angeles. We have John Eric Dowdle and Drew Dowdle, and joining us live from Wyoming, the author of the Joe Pickett books, CJ Chuck Fox. Gentlemen, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much.
And let me just see if we have our other guests coming up. John, Eric, Drew and CJ are all with us now.
Great, thank you. You have Drew Dowdle here.
And John Dowdle right here.
And John's here. Yeah, great.
And CJ, Chuck.
I'm here. Thank you.
All right, we got it. And we'll start with you, Chuck. What had you decide after writing these best-selling novels that it was time to turn it into a TV series?
Well, I mean, I was never trying to turn it into a TV series. I was writing a series of books. I had always hoped that if it, if it ever came to life as either television or movies, that it would be at least authentic to the thought behind the series and the characters and the family portrayed within. And I'm happy to say that this effort right now for the Joe Pickett Show is the best I could have ever hoped for. It's got everything right, the tone, the casting, the family, the storyline, the look. I couldn't be happier. And we've had some false starts in the past and some bad attempts in the past, but this is I couldn't be more thrilled.
Thank you, Chuck.
John Eric, how did you and Drew get involved with CJ to make this happen?
Well, we actually did not, I'm embarrassed to say we didn't actually know the book series until we had done a series called Waco, and Doug Wick at Red Wagon Pictures sent us the first book in the series, and it took us like 10 pages. We were about 10 pages in, and we're like, this is the greatest thing I've ever read. There is something about early in the book, Joe Pickett gets his gun taken away from him by a poacher, And there's just something in that moment where, like, oh, it's like a new take on the Western genre where the hero isn't perfect. He's not Clint Eastwood. He's not, like, just, like, steel face. Like, he makes mistakes. He has a family he's doing his best with. There's something really relatable and very human about him. And I'd never seen anything in this space like that. And Drew and I, it took us like 10 minutes and we were like, oh, we need to be involved with this. And we voraciously read the books and just went so down the rabbit hole. And we're CJ Box super fans at this point.
Drew, what did you and John take away from the experience on Waco, which we covered, by the way, when it was running? I think it was on Paramount Network, one of the first major miniseries since they moved from Spike TV to Paramount. What did you both learn from doing that series that you brought into Joe Pickett?
Well, first of all, it was our first TV. Waco was our first TV experience. We had only been in features before that, so we learned quite a bit. That was, you know, a 6-episode, more limited, but we just loved the process of TV. We loved what you can do with character and how you can really get to know characters. You can really, you know, write serious character arcs that you just don't have time to do in features. And so from that, we basically said, let's just live in TV. This is so fun. This perfectly suits us. And we love the process of creating, but we also love the process of production. And so we very much were looking for something that was like 10 episodes, hopefully multiple seasons. You know, that was very much what we wanted to do. And it was like the stars aligned and getting that book from Red Wagon, you know, Open Season, Chuck's first Joe Pickett book. It was like just the perfect fit. And also shooting Waco in New Mexico, we were kind of in this landscape that we were really, we've always wanted to do something, you know, in the Western genre. And we were living in the kind of, you know, outskirts of New Mexico. And it just felt like we wanted to make something in the Western genre even more than we had in the past. And again, that book came our way. And as John said, it was just so different. And like, not only is the Joe Pickett character different, but the family at the center of it, and a family dealing with real stress and a family dealing with real history of trauma and things like that were all elements that just spoke so directly to us. So I'd say, you know, Waco really flipped the switch for us in terms of wanting to do more long form content. And I can't think of any, you know, any IP that would be better to do many seasons of than the Joe Pickett novels. They're just amazing.
We're talking about Joe Pickett. It is the latest Spectrum original that will premiere on video on demand through Spectrum or Charter Communication cable systems around the country starting a week from today. We've got the three key executive producers responsible for the program, John Eric Dowdle, Drew Dowdle. They both join us live from Los Angeles. And from a ranch in Wyoming, TJ Box. He is the creator of the character and the best-selling novel that the series comes from. And they're all with us live this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised in another Internet Radio exclusive. Simon Abbott with you live from New York, 41 degrees now at the top of the hour. And we invite you to get involved with the show with your phone call. So make that happen, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. We have another two-hour extravaganza coming your way on Wednesday, less than 48 hours from now, to kick off your December 1st. On the program, we will have, in the first hour, two programming services, one that just started on Roku, and the other is now available on many smart TV sets and devices, and is about to make a big leap to try to become the Netflix of environmental programming. We're talking about Swerve Sports and EarthX TV. From Swerve TV and Swerve Sports, the chief executive of that venture, former Roku executive Steve Shannon, will be with us in the first half hour. And in the second, Earth TV or EarthX TV head, former Ride TV founder, Michael Fletcher. And then have we got a whale of a second hour for you. First up, we will have from Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, which is about to complete its two-season award-winning run with a holiday movie on the Roku channel, creator and executive producer, Austin Weinberg. And finally, The Real Housewives are invading scripted television with a made-for-TV movie premiering on Peacock next week, The Housewives of the North Pole. That's North Pole, Vermont, folks. And we will have the co-stars of that made-for-TV movie, Betsy Brandt, and former Real Housewives Los Angeles personality, Kyle Richards. That's all coming up Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here. Another big two-hour show for you to kick off December on Tomorrow We Televise. CJ, what was the most important thing that you wanted John, Eric, and Dowdle to have in this series about your character of Joe Pickett, what he's like, what he deals with, and the environment that he deals with, he and his family?
Well, I think both John and Drew have touched upon it, and that is the fact that, you know, I mean, I never started writing the series thinking everybody is just waiting for a Wyoming Game Warden mystery series and that I'm the one that can deliver that. I knew there would have to be a lot more to it than the protagonist's profession. So I tried to put a lot of that into the very first book, and that is about, you know, it's a real guy, it's a real profession in a real place with real issues that are pertinent to people who not only live here but might be interested in it. And the most important thing to me all along was that the family. Joe Pickett is unlike, you know, most PIs or detectives or other protagonists in mystery series, and that he's happily married with a very young family and a much smarter wife, and that they're all part of the story. That isn't to mean it's all kind of – it's not a Hallmark story by any means, but everybody's involved because of their isolated nature. And I had hoped that that would always be translated from the page to the screen or to the TV set, that this is about a family that are all struggling against sometimes external measures, and that it would be portrayed accurately. And it has been. I've been lucky enough to have been to the set and seen the first 5 episodes now, and I just couldn't be happier. It's everything. In fact, things I even thought about but didn't put on the page are on the show. I don't know how they did that. Maybe the donor can explain it. But for an author to see his novel brought to the screen like this in such rich detail is a dream come true.
And John, Eric, you and Drew are dealing with a very multi-layered storyline and multi-layered character, because this person is a game warden. He is dealing with what his town is dealing with, both the environment and the economy. He's dealing with a crime, a murder crime. He's dealing with poaching and local law enforcement. How do you balance the layers so that you get a full-bodied story for the viewer?
Well, I mean, we spend a lot of time in the writer's room focusing on each of those aspects and spending, you know, time with each of the characters. You know, we like to go through in every episode each character's journey emotionally through that episode, what they're dealing with personally, you know, in themselves and in the town and in their relationships. And then we craft the story, you know, so we go through every episode we write, you know, sort of each character top to bottom. And, you know, one thing we always tried to do is, like, we always tried to beat the book. And I'll say, like, it was just such a demoralizing experience, like writing scene after scene of, like, okay, I'm going to write the heck out of the scene. And then looking back at the book and going, damn it, Chuck wrote it so much better. Like, and then, like, pulling in his dialogue back into, like, being like, we kept trying to beat it, and it was just – the material was so good. It just, like, created such a rich tapestry. There's so much humor and pathos, and it was just – there was just so much in the material. Like, really, at the end of the day, we really just didn't want to ruin what worked so well in the books, and we tried to just support the original material and not change it dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Drew, how long did it take to find your Joe Pickett, namely after Michael Dorman?
It took just a little bit. Like, the casting process always is kind of takes a life of its own, and it's a question of who's really right for it and who's interested in it and who's available to do it. You know, it's all these things. But we have a philosophy in casting that, you know, you'll find it'll become totally clear when you find the right guy. And if you're not sure, then you don't have the right guy. And And it was just, it was almost like a perfect storm. We all, you know, we loved him in the show Patriot. We just thought he was brilliant in that. And the second he kind of, you know, came up and became available to potentially do Joe Pickett and was potentially interested, it was just so abundantly clear to us that he was the perfect guy. I mean, he has an incredible likability to him. He's also really, you know, tough and cool and can play Joe in that way, but he has just such a, there's such a pathos to him as an actor and as a human, and he's just an incredibly nice person. He just felt so much like Joe, just naturally. And you just know when you start talking to the studio network and everyone has the same exact, just, you know, unbridled enthusiasm for this choice, that that we're onto something. And so it was maybe a little late in our process, but when it came up, it was just so clear to everyone. And we just feel like that was the single most important decision in this whole process, and this whole show was casting Joe. And we feel like that one we just hit out of the park, we think.
Drew, how dream a dream cast do you have? I mean, you have people like David Alan Greer, who we've seen in both dramatic and comedic roles. You got Sharon Lawrence, we all remember her from NYPD Blue and a lot of other things. You have some new faces, too. It comes across like for a venture like this, a really dream cast.
Completely. I mean, we could not be happier across the board. It just felt like, you know, with each actor that we cast, it just kept getting better and better, and each actor being so perfect for their particular role. We literally have never had a casting experience quite so perfect as this one, frankly.
Joe Pickett, it's the newest Spectrum original miniseries, and it could become a series if it works great. And you'll be able to see it starting Monday. If you're a Charter cable subscriber or a Spectrum cable subscriber around the country, you can see it through video on demand, free, by the way. And then next year it'll run on Paramount Plus, available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices, programmed by Viacom CBS. We've got the three executive producers involved with this series. We have got John Eric Dowdle and Drew Dowdle. They both joined us live from Los Angeles. And from Wyoming, the author of the Joe Pickett best-selling books, CJ Chuck Box. They're all with us live this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. And happy you are, too, on this Cyber Monday 2021. Happy Hanukkah, by the way. First day to all of you celebrating that festival of lights. Simon Avon with you live from New York. If you have a question or comment, mini minutes with this trio, make the call go, 646-652-2906. Or use the chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Coming up for the bottom of the hour, some thoughts about somebody who was going for a TV career. He didn't get it, and this person made a shift. And I can tell you this, the American Musical Theater and Entertainment is happy this person did. We'll tell you about who that is a little bit in the near the bottom of the hour. CJ, as you are watching the show get produced, what impressed you about the way that this show is going in terms of the quality of the scripts, the quality of the directing, where it was shot? What really, you know, impressed you the most?
Well, I mean, I would say all of the above. When I visited the script or the set, before I got to meet anybody or meet the actors or anything, I was able to, with John, tour the sets. And that may sound really mundane, but the sets were so perfect to what I had in mind, not only what was in the book, but was in my head, that there was sort of, I realized there was a very kind of strange mind meld going on. I mean, to the point where posters that I had in my office were also in Joe Pickett's office on the set in Calgary, and there's no way anyone could have known that was the case. So everything was just right. I couldn't believe that there would be such an accurate rendering of things I put on the page and things I thought about. So it started there. But then when I met the cast, I've never been around such a happy crew and bunch of people in a place that was kind of cold and rainy at the time. But there was a definite, really happy vibe coming from everybody that I felt it was a success even before I saw 2 minutes of it on a computer. And it's turned out that's pretty much turned out the way it's been, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. John Eric, where did you shoot? Where did you film Joe Pickett? And were there any issues either with nature or with the pandemic?
We shot in Calgary, around Calgary, Alberta, Canada, which is like due north of Wyoming, so it has a lot of the same, you know, land and sort of a western like cowboy ethos. Yes, the pandemic was in full effect. We basically moved up there for the run of show, and unfortunately, you know, the actors couldn't come and go. Anyone in the show had to stay there, run a show because the borders were closed. There were some real challenges with that. And Calgary, you know, one of the interesting things with Calgary is it has the quickest shift in weather that I've ever seen anywhere ever. Like it could be, you know, dump a foot of snow and by lunch it's all gone, and, you know, and the next day it's raining and then it's, you know, sunshine. Like we had to be ready to just play through whatever. And it created a real, a real sense of, you know, improvisation or playing jazz with nature, where, you know, you can't predict it, you know, 2 hours into the future. You have to just sort of roll with it, whatever nature gives you. And in that sense, I feel like that, you know, Joe Pickett has to deal with nature on its own terms. And it seemed fitting that we as a crew and the cast had to also just roll with nature, whatever nature brings us on a particular day.
Mm-hmm. True. If both of you and Chuck get a second season of Beyond of Joe Pickett, how do you want to further develop the story? Where do you want to take it? What direction do you want to take it?
Oh God, that's almost one of the challenges is just how many directions we could take it. I mean, that's one huge benefit of having all of Chuck's books, you know, to draw from. And I don't want to get too ahead of it or kind of tip where it's going too much publicly yet. But obviously we like staying true to these books. We've gone, you know, into considering season two very much like we did season one. Like, you know, let's go with what's really working in the books and let's use this incredible material we have available to us versus trying to invent, you know, too much out of whole cloth, because it's not necessary. It's just, there's so many good characters and so many good storylines here. And I know that's kind of a vague answer and I apologize, but I guess that's the challenge of this is almost too much good material.
Yeah. Chuck, over the years on this program, we've interviewed a number of novelists who were so impressed by how their novels were adapted for either television series or miniseries that they became scriptwriters for episodic TV themselves. Have you caught the TV writing bug as a result of this?
I have not. No. What I see is that that's a totally different discipline, totally different thought process. I'm completing my second novel of the year right now. Before we had this call, that's what I do. That's what I like to do. But that's also why I admire John and Drew and the way that they were able to adapt things on the page to things on TV and the, you know, the dialogue and how it moves along and sometimes compresses things. And I'm not so sure I could do that well. So no, I do not have that bug at all. My contribution is to write the source material and then praise the television show.
And John, Eric, and Drew, while you wait for word from Spectrum whether you can go ahead with season two, get that green light. Are you working on any other series concepts or miniseries concepts?
Yes, we have a season two of Waco coming out, and we're in a writer's room. I'm probably not supposed to talk about this, but I'll apologize later. But we're in a writer's room. Starting to work through season two's worth of material for Joe Pickett, which is very exciting to us all.
Great to hear. By the way, the Waco season two, is that going to be on Paramount Plus, or will that go on Paramount Network again?
Paramount Network then right into Paramount Plus is how I understand it. Don't quote me.
All right, there we go. Joe Pickett, Season one, hopefully of many, will begin a week from today on Spectrum Originals. That's the original video on demand service of original programming that you can get if you are a customer of Spectrum. That's the cable systems around the country owned by Charter Communications, one of the top cable operators in the nation. So check your local listings if you're a Spectrum customer, what channel that the series will be running, along with other Spectrum Originals as well. And next year, it will be running on Paramount Plus, and we'll let you know when that happens. But in the meantime, more details about the series and where you can find it on Video On Demand, go to www.spectrumoriginals.com. That's www.spectrumoriginals.com. Joe Pickett, season one, hopefully of many, begins a week from today. John Eric Dowdle, Drew Dowdle, CJ Box, thank you all very much for being with us. It's been a pleasure all the way. Good luck with the series. Hopefully next Monday is the beginning of a super run. And keep us posted on, and John and Drew, keep us posted on the second season of Waco. We'd love to have you back to talk about it.
We would love that.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Simon. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And all of you have a wonderful holiday season.
Thank you.
You too. Thanks, Simon.
John Eric Dowdle, Drew Dowdle, CJ Box, all joining us live. The Dowdles from Los Angeles and CJ from a ranch in Wyoming right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. In 1953, a TV series came on that adapted a very popular movie of the 1930s called Topper. If you remember the movie, it starred Cary Grant as George Kirby, who with his wife Marion had an auto accident, and they became ghosts with the most, and they decided to haunt a sophisticated man by the name of Cosmo Topper. Well, the series starred the husband and wife team then of Ann Jeffries and Robert Sterling as the ghosts, the Kirbys, and Leo G. Carroll, the veteran character actor, as Cosmo Topper. The show ran two seasons on CBS, was sponsored by Camel Cigarettes, and many of the episodes in season one were written by a writing team. One of the writers was George Oppenheim. He stayed with the show for the second season. His writing partner, however, did not, because that writing partner decided to do something else. The writing partner was Stephen Sondheim. That's right, Stephen Sondheim. And what turned out to be comedic television's or episodic TV's loss was the American Musical Theater's gain, one of the biggest it ever had. Because several years later, Stephen Sondheim made his mark with Leonard Bernstein, providing the lyrics to Bernstein's music of what I consider to be still the greatest American musical ever made, West Side Story. And then from there, the lyrics for Gypsy, the lyrics for Do I Hear a Waltz with music by Richard Rodgers, and then a string of sensational musicals which he did both the music and lyrics for, from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, to Company, to Anyone Can Whistle, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, Assassins, Pacific Overtures, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe the greatest collection of innovative American musicals ever made. And when Stephen Sondheim wrote a musical, he always tried not to repeat himself, but always just keep innovating, keep growing, keep going, which he did. Oh, yes, and along the way, in 1966, Stephen Sondheim wrote one of the few original musicals, in fact, the only original musical he ever did, for television. It was called Evening Primrose, and it was put together for ABC Stage 67, an anthology series at the time that did everything from scripted television shows to original one-act plays to musicals to documentaries, all sorts of things. And Evening Primrose was one of the first highlights of ABC Stage 67, and incidentally, I believe you can see it on YouTube. It's one of a number of Stage 67 musicals, Stage 7 shows that were on. Stephen Sondheim was as genius a genius as you could get either in musical theater or any musical theater. And although he only, as I said, did one musical for television, you did see many of his performances or scenes from his work on many a Tony Awards presentation or on many a PBS musical presentation. And he also did an interview with Andre Previn, himself a wonderful composer and conductor, on the PBS series Previn and the Pittsburgh, one of that series' best episodes. As you know by now, Stephen Sondheim passed away this weekend at the age of 91, quietly, peacefully, with family and friends, and with his facilities and his way with music intact right up to the end. And I understand that there are some musicals that did not make Broadway or off-Broadway that, who knows, might see the light of day in the years to come. Stephen Sondheim, TV's loss, was entertainment and the American musical theater's gain, and we're all the better for it. And, of course, West Side Story in a few weeks will come out in the brand-new version on film directed by Steven Spielberg. Hopefully it will be a hit, and it will once again show how brilliant a genius Stephen Sondheim was. And you can bet your boots that from here on in, somebody, somehow, some way, somewhere, will play a Sondheim musical somewhere in this world for years to come. When we come back, Netflix premieres the third and final season of Lost in Space this Wednesday. Zach Estrin, the adapter, executive producer, and showrunner of the series, he joins us live from Los Angeles after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn.com. Together, reaching over 65 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Remember, this Thursday, BTR is your home for the Blackout Hour, a very unusual musical hour devoted to independent music and independent artists. That's the Blackout Hour, Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, only on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, that's BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to our final 30 minutes of an amazing two-hour edition of Tomorrow Be Televised on this Cyber Monday and first day of Hanukkah 2021. Sondheim, I'm with you, still along for the ride with all of you. Thank you for staying with us if you've been with us from the start. And if you have a question or comment for our upcoming guest, don't be shy. Make that phone ring, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Again, we're sorry that our chat room is not happening. The gremlins are still at work from pre-Thanksgiving, but we will talk to Blog Talk Radio, and we'll try to get that fixed up by our next show this coming Wednesday. A couple of years ago, Netflix decided to take one of the 1960s top science fiction series and turn it into a series all its own, Lost in Space. And it certainly has done so, winning rave reviews for its cast, its production values, and more importantly, its unique storylines of what Irwin Allen originally created and produced back in the mid-1960s. Well, joining us live to talk about the third and final season of Lost in Space, which premieres less than 48 hours from now, Wednesday, on Netflix, on smart TV sets and smart devices, the adapter, executive producer, and showrunner in an internet radio exclusive, Zach Estrin. Zach, welcome.
Thank you so much. Very happy to be here. Although after listening to the all the talk of Sondheim, it did make me wish that we did a musical episode this year. I've got to be honest.
I know. It really is amazing when you learn that he was a very good writer on television with his work with George Oppenheim. He actually wrote like about 10, 11 episodes of season one of Topper.
That was so fascinating to learn. I was really excited to listen to that.
So, Zach, what's it been like for you to take this series from first season revival to third season conclusion?
Oh, it's been fantastic. I mean, you know, with the help of Matt Sazam and Burke Sharpless, who created this new edition, you know, it's a lot of people look at things of remakes and sometimes they're kind of like, you know, hey, why do this thing again? And so we really wanted to approach this classic story in a very different way, so it didn't just feel like we were repeating an experience that had already been seen, you know, especially because the tone of the 60s show was so much, you know, different than the tone of television today. So it was important to us to kind of keep that core of the storytelling, you know, which was this family up against incredible odds, but tell it in a way that is more contemporary with what the audiences are used to these days. And, you know, no men in big rubber suits and silver painted robots, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Lost in Space, when it came out in the 1960s, was beloved because of the cast, because of Dr. Smith, because of Will Robinson, the robot. There were all sorts of things that made it a very popular series for three seasons on CBS. There was also, though, behind the scenes, there was a lot of criticism about Irwin Allen, not just for this show, but the other shows he did. And the criticism was always, you come up with these wonderful concepts like Lost in Space and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and Time Tunnel and Land of the Giants, but then you make it a Crisis of the Week show. Rather than explore the concept of being lost in space or the concept of a time tunnel, you have your characters, there's no character development, there's no storyline development, it's all get the crisis going, get them in, get them out. Was that something that was on top of mind doing this version of Lost in Space, that we're not, because we don't have the 1960s issues with television that Irwin Allen had to deal with, that we can really develop the characters, develop the storyline, do things that Irwin couldn't do back in the 60s?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is kind of the greatest time to be making television. I mean, with all the streamers and the way that they allow you to produce things, it's such a luxury to be a writer and producer during this time. I mean, you know, coming you know, even just a huge difference from not just from the 60s, but from even 10 years ago with how we were making television. You know, the network schedule, where when I was doing shows on ABC, you know, it was 22 episodes a year, nonstop production. You're always in prep and production and post simultaneously. It can just get overwhelming. And I think now that you're in this world of streamers where you can really write the show first, you can take, you know, 6 months, write it all out, figure it out, then film it, you know, and then for us especially, it takes about 7 months of post before we can even get this show from finished production to being on air. Like, having the luxury of that time schedule and the luxury of being able to, you know, not have to crank out as many episodes, you don't have those sort of stalls that you used to have, and that you still get, I think, a lot of network television. And, you know, the story of the Robinsons is such a kind of a classic one that being able to tell this in a more long-form way, as you said, avoiding just the, oh, what creature is going to show up this week, and really get into these people has been just a dream come true, frankly. And hopefully, you know, for the audiences as well. You know, we've been fortunate enough to get to be very close with a lot of the original cast members who are still with us and have their involvement in the show, both on camera and off. And so that's just been great to have their blessing and hearing their old stories about what it was like making it. And the friendship between our Will Robinson and Bill Mumy, the original Will Robinson, has been just a joy to watch as well.
Mm-hmm. What's it been like to have those surviving cast members be involved, like Billy and Marta Kristen, to be involved in the series and to use their expertise of what they had to go through into what to avoid in terms of characterization of the various members of the Robinson clan?
You know, it was before we even started, we would have these big dinners, thanks to Kevin Burns, who had maintained a relationship with the original cast for a long time, and he was kind of, you know, close to Irwin as well. And so being able to talk to them about their experiences both on and off camera was just incredible. And actually one of the best things, I think, was how Bill Mumy and Max Jenkins, who plays our Will Robinson, got to share time together and talk about not just about Will Robinson, but about growing up as a child actor and the challenges that face you and the pitfalls. And, you know, Bill was somebody who had a lot of longevity in his career from, you know, being, you know, a young actor and being able to hold on to himself financially and stably and emotionally and all of those things. And I, you know, him talking to Max a lot has been just great. And you know, I think it's important to honor the original show. You know, even as we do ours completely differently, we want to invite all of those fans of the original into this version. And I think we've been pretty successful in doing that. And I think it's been kind of a great little gift for those fans of the original to see these faces now all grown up in the new version. And each season we've had a little opportunity to introduce a different person each season, a different member from the original cast. And we had some challenges doing that this year with COVID, because travel was very challenging and things of that nature, but we managed to get a little special Easter egg in episode 7 that fans of the original, I think, might appreciate.
Yeah. As a child actor, in addition to doing Lost in Space, many people remember Billy Mumy for It's a Good Life, the classic Twilight Zone episode,
yes,
where he plays Anthony, who wishes people in the cornfield. And for some people, it's a very frightening episode. But he also did an episode on videotape called Long Distance Call, where he plays a child who is invited by his dead grandmother through a toy telephone to do certain things and almost commits suicide. And if you ever read The Twilight Zone Companion by Mark Scott Sacree, there's a lot of discussion about him having to deal with that scene where they try to fish him out of the swimming pool and bring him back to life. It just seems, though, that he's one of those child actors that came through that period so well, so adjusted. I saw him on Babylon 5. He was terrific in that role for that series. He just seems that he's the kind of a person that really has grown into a very terrific adult.
Yeah, it really is. And just, you know, really caring. You know, a lot of people, I think, as they get older, when they had, you know, him as a young man, and as a child, you kind of see them go through that period where they reject those things that brought them attention earlier. And Bill has really I think, held on to a real affection for that family that they created there. And they may have, you know, gone through various periods of ups and downs, but being able to sit at a table and see these people who shared the screen together still in contact and still friends and still telling old stories and jokes, it's just great. And Bill, you know, not just his acting, but his musicianship. He's been doing, you know, in bands, and he's been writing, and he just did another companion book. I think he and Angela Cartwright just put out another book with some more stories of the old Lost in Space thing. And so he's always, you know, keeping busy and so level-headed, and such a great mentor for our young Max Jenkins. It's a gift.
The third and final season of Lost in Space, the Netflix version, comes to Netflix and most smart TV sets and smart TV devices this Wednesday, December 1st. And we've got the adapter of the original concept created and produced by Irwin Allen back in the 60s on CBS. He's also the executive producer and the showrunner, Zach Eskrin. He's with us live from Los Angeles this half hour in an internet radio exclusive on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Tom, I'm with you live from New York. If you have a question or comment for our guest, make the phone go, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Once again, if you just joined us late, we have another big two-hour episode coming your way on December 1st, kicking off your final month of 2021, and we have a great super lineup in store for you. We've got from the new Smart TV distributed service, Swerve Sports, Chief Executive Officer, former Roku Executive, Steve Shannon, the former head of Ride TV, now head of Earth X TV, Michael Fletcher. Then, the creator and executive producer of Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, which, less than 48 hours from now, will be showing its final episode, a holiday-themed movie version, on Roku Channel. The creator and executive producer, Austin Weinberg, joins us in a radio exclusive. And finally, the co-stars of the first-ever Real Housewives made-for-TV scripted movie coming to Peacock next week, The Housewives of the North Pole, Betsy Brandt, and from the Real Housewives of Los Angeles, Kyle Richards. That's all coming your way Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific. Don't miss. Tell your friends. It's going to be a very special 2 hours for you and for this week. Zach, in this third season, it looks like the Robinsons are split up. You have the parents involved in a crisis, and you also have the children involved. Explain how that goes and how you wanted this third season to evolve.
We sort of, you know, ended season two with this big choice that had to be made. Like, it's one of those, you know, kind of Sophie's Choice moments where it's like someone's going to be able to get away and avoid this attack, but they can only, you know, hold enough people on one ship to make it away. And so all the grown-ups decide to put all the kids onto a ship, and they are the ones who kind of get away to safety at the end of season two, and they leave behind their parents. You know, for us, we wanted to begin this season exploring what it's like for these people who have always been together to be separate. And we actually jumped for a year. So when season three starts, it's a year after that decision. And we see what the Robinson kids have become a year away from their parents. And we also see the parents a year away from their kids. In a way, it's this sort of, you know, on steroids version of like what it's like to have an empty nest when your kids go off to college or something to that effect. And you don't know what they're doing, what they're up to, if they're okay. And the parents are exploring who they are now without their kids and wrestling with that loss, you know, particularly for Maureen Robinson. She is battling the ghosts of the not knowing. She talks about the not knowing is the hardest part. You know, they think their kids got away to safety, but they don't really know because they haven't been in contact. And the Robinson kids, you know, has had a lot on their shoulders throughout the show, and now they have to deal with it without the guidance of their family. And for us, it was just, how do we tell a different version of these stories going into season three and freshen it up? And some of that is sort of pulling apart some of the fabric that we worked so hard to put together in season one and two.
And in this season for the Robinson kids, there's something, I don't know if Irwin Allen or his production team ever thought about this in the original series, but this idea of trying to deal with a group of colonists, almost 100, and to try to bring them out of a tough situation on their current planet and bring them to a whole new world.
Did Irwin Allen ever deal with that?
Yeah, and I'm wondering how that came to be, because I don't remember Irwin Allen coming through with that kind of plot. And I think this is a very interesting aspect of the third season, is that you, in addition to trying to bring the family back together, you also have the Robinson kids, you know, Judy, Penny, Will, et cetera, and the robot, all trying to bring these colonists from this planet that's fall apart to try to bring them to a new civilization.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think we're all looking at every day we're seeing in the news, right, that, you know, NASA's exploring possible life elsewhere. You know, you're seeing, you know, oh, we've discovered, you know, possible habitable place on Proxima Beta, X number of millions of light years away, and they're talking about how we can, you know, possibly find life elsewhere. Can we survive on Mars? Are there colonies that we can build there? It seems like we are spending a lot of time and energy looking for where we might be able to go to if this planet continues to have challenges, versus sort of spending that time and energy on how to maybe fix the challenges here, which is always fascinating to me, right? Like, maybe shouldn't we just be working a little bit harder to stay here versus looking for how we can get away? But in Lost in Space, they sort of find themselves with a planet that is suffering due to this, what they all believe is this meteor impact on the planet. But if you watch the show, you will kind of discover that it was caused by something else. But yeah, you know, it is something that I think is kind of relatable. I think a lot of people think about as we, you know, deal with climate change here, we deal with possible overpopulation, we deal with, you know, lots of changes. There's this natural, I think, inclination to sort of dream of, could we ever live elsewhere? Could we ever survive? And so that's kind of what the Robinsons are dealing with now, is it's not like a choice to leave. They actually are all kind of slowly, one by one, doing these missions away from Earth to get everybody to hopefully a more survivable environment.
A week ago, we had Marcella Blanc, who played Mary Ellen on The Waltons Homecoming, that was the new version of the movie that got the Waltons going 50 years ago on the CW last night. And for those who missed it, we had in our news notes the fact that nearly a million people saw that episode, that show last night. And when Marcella was on the program, she said that she had talked to Judy Norton, who was the original Mary Ellen, and it really helped her not only understand the character more, but also help her interpret the character in some different ways. Was that the same with the people playing the Robinson kids, talking to Marta Kristen or talking to Billy Mumy or Angela Cartwright, that having the experience of being with them, that helped them form their characters and take on some different things that they didn't do?
You know, I think that each of the characters on our show kind of wanted to make this version of the Robinsons family kind of uniquely different than perhaps the original. And so I know that there was like a lot of, you know, work to try to kind of create this new and different version and not just sort of repeat the version of the Robinsons that were there before. But there was also a lot of unavoidable similarities in some of the stories that we were encountering. And so I know that our cast, particularly like Parker Posey, who is our Dr. Smith, obviously one of our big challenges was trying to figure out, how do you do Dr. Smith in a way that, you know, you can't really outdo what was done before by Jonathan. And so we sort of wanted to turn it on its head and actually have somebody who, as you watch the show, you'll come to understand, sort of assumes the identity of Dr. Smith. And it's Parker Posey, who has her own completely unique take on the character. But she grew up, what was so cool was that she actually grew up with Lost in Space being a huge part of her life. And so when we first got on the phone, you know, she as a woman was like so excited about this possibility, because she'd actually just written her own book about how Lost in Space, I think there was like a chapter in her book about how Lost in Space was a huge part of her childhood, and particularly the character of Dr. Smith. And so for her getting a chance to kind of revisit this and reinvent it, I think was just a real special treat for her. And I think intentionally not wanting to try to do an imitation version of that character from before, who was, you know, delicious and extravagant, and but Parker wanted to sort of honor that, but do her own spin, her own different spin, of course.
Zach Efron is the adapter, executive producer, showrunner of the Netflix version of Lost in Space, which coming your way on Wednesday, December 1st, will be have its third and final season of a terrific series, produced by Legendary, by the way. And if you have a question or comment for Zach in our final moments with him, give us a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Number good anywhere. You're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio. Also coming up, we have an up segment on GameStar Plus, the interactive game and game show service with Steve Harvey as chief spokesperson and investor. We have an update on that, and we'll try one more time to give our classic trivia question, if you missed it, in our last hour, four prizes in play. What feedback have you gotten from, are people from Irwin Allen's community still alive, and what do they have to say about, what feedback have they given you about the series?
You know, there was a lot of, I think, trepidation from fans of the original, you know, going into this, because, you know, the there was a movie X number of years ago that I think got a fairly sort of a mixed response, to be honest. And I think that there was, you know, people hold a very special place. This story meant a lot to a lot of people. You know, yes, it was kind of campy and silly, but there was but it tapped into something that people really responded to, and they continued to hold this Robinson family near and dear to their heart, even as, you know, television changed over the years. But Kevin Burns, who I mentioned before, who kind of been carrying the torch of this show and a number of other Irwin Allen properties, really had stayed in touch with this audience. And they would seek him out on Facebook or message boards and places to try to ask, you know, or maybe even criticize the idea of going forward with this. And he kind of just held on to them and said, just trust us. We love this show as much as you do, and we want to give you something that will make you feel the same way but told in a different way. And almost universally, the reaction that we have had has been fantastic. I think people really respect how much we respected the original and how we would sort of have our little homages to various things that they knew and loved. But this is a universal story, this you know, family facing a crisis. You know, originally it was the Swiss Family Robinson, right? And then they sort of took it to space, and it became the Space Family Robinson, and then it became Lost in Space. And so, you know, we always looked at this show as a show about a family who could have been lost and struggling anywhere. They could have been shipwrecked. They could have been, you know, stranded in a blackout. They just happened to be in space. And that's one of the things that Irwin always talked about, was just the family was the core of the show, not necessarily the things that they encountered. It's how they reacted to them.
Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia, is on the line. Rick, go ahead with your question. We have a few minutes left.
Hey, Zach. Since the show is wrapping up, first I want to say the show is awesome. It's amazing what you've
Thank
done
you,
with
Rick.
This. Will the robot actually go on to be in a show, get his own show, or anything else?
You know, we when you watch the end of this season, you'll kind of see that we've planted the seeds for, you know, possible future things. You know, for us, we wanted to really tell this one complete chapter, so you had that feeling of a real complete journey. But this is a story that is universal and can kind of live on and spin off and do other things, whether that's Netflix or somewhere else or in different mediums. You know, a lot of, you know, there's animation, there's books, there's stories, there's video games, there's podcasts. You know, the robot is such a special and unique character. God, I would hope that he could live on and explore other things. But I really, really appreciate your kind words about the show. It means a lot to us.
Rick Webb from Philadelphia, thank you so much for the call. Zach, in our mini moments, what's next for you?
You know, just now that this is wrapped up, I'm still at Netflix for another couple of years, and we're all talking about what the next thing to do is. So I have a couple things in development with them, things that I'm co-writing, things that I'm supervising, things that I'm writing on my own, but really enjoying the freedom as a storyteller for what
Netflix has opportunities to do. And so I have some things that are sci-fi, some things that are more grounded, like Ozark. You know, there's just like a lot of different possibilities for what comes next. And I hope that the people who have fallen in love with this show and how we did it will continue to follow to whatever comes next that I do.
And by the way, the final season of Ozark begins in early 2022 on Netflix, Emmy Award winner, I might add. And you hope also that...
I love that show.
Your...
I was just saying, I love that show.
By the way, yeah. Do you hope that what you've done with Lost in Space will inspire either you or others to maybe adapt other own work? I, for example, would love to see The Time Tunnel come back. I think that show was very underrated, and I think there's an opportunity to really do what Irwin could have done for that show now, or Land of the Giants.
I could not agree more. You know, Irwin had a unique gift for finding those core ideas that can continue to live on. And from what I understand, some of them are in the works actually as we speak with some of the people who've been involved in our show as well. But I would love to see some more of those properties carried forward. Now, you know, with the technology that we have now, my God, I think it could just be truly exciting. I couldn't agree more with you.
And I mentioned one more. It was an NBC pilot called City Beneath the Sea. I really like that. And maybe it's time for that to come on as well. The third and final season of Lost in Space comes your way Wednesday, December 1st on Netflix, available on smart TV sets and smart devices all over the place. And more details on the show and the service, www.netflix.com, www.netflix.com. Lost in Space, Season 3, third and final, come your way this Wednesday. Zach Estrin, thank you so much for a wonderful time this half hour with you. We'd love to have you back anytime. Congratulations to you and everybody involved in bringing Lost in Space home for a great, great third run.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, and I'll talk to you soon.
You guys, let's make it happen, Zach. Take care. All the greatest, and happy holiday season.
Take care. You too.
Zach Estrin from Lost in Space joining us live from Los Angeles. And finally, quickly, up as an update, catching up on guests and topics on this program. In a news note section a couple of months ago, we talked about GameStar Plus. That's the interactive game and game show service with Steve Harvey as investor and chief spokesperson. Well, we checked with WeFunder, which they still have a campaign going on. It's WeFunder.com. And as of this afternoon, GameStar Plus has raised $4,426,530 for more than 1,800 people. That's $4,426,530. And we'll keep you posted on how that is going. Sorry we don't have time for the classic trivia question again, but if we don't get a win by the end today, post it tomorrow on Facebook and on Twitter. Thanks to all of our guests for a fantastic 2 hours. Another big 2-hour extravaganza coming your way less than 48 hours from now. The views expressed here are those of the participants, not those of Blog Talk Radio and other distributors of this program. Andy Cho is Blog Talk Radio's general manager, Jay Sonnenberg, head of content. Website made inspired by PodSite, the Internet's new podcast destination. For more, go to podsite.io. Our web coordinator is guitarist Fakus. Marvin Televised brought to you today by Audible.com, the audio marketplace of Amazon.com. Remember, Audible transforms the way you hear the world. For a trial, 1-month trial run, and a special offer, $5.95 a month for the first few months of subscription. You order now, audibletrial.com/televised. It's Marvin Televised. I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a great rest of your Monday, Cyber Monday that is, and first night of Hanukkah 2, second night of Hanukkah, first day. And we'll be back on Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific, 2-hour extravaganza. You know where, Blog Talk Radio, Speaker Tuner Radio, and all of our podcast affiliates. Remember, whatever you do with you now and then, please make it safe, make it great. Haven't been vaccinated, see your doctor, check your medical history, and then make a great choice. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.